From 90.5 WESA, this is The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. A new legislative session began in Harrisburg this week, with Republicans holding a large majority in both the Senate and the House.
The majority party does have an obligation to govern, and the minority party has an obligation to participate and be a part of moving legislation forward.
That might be the job of legislators, but one of the jobs of the media is to explore government operations, and that is the focus of a new investigative newspaper that launched this week. Also, new housing developments keep popping up throughout the region, with price tags on homes starting at a few hundred thousand dollars. But local leaders say greater attention needs to be drawn toward affordable housing. And we'll talk to longtime Pittsburgh columnist Jack Kelly, who bid farewell this week. That's coming up on The Confluence, our weekly news roundup after this news update. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. A new legislative session began this week, and with it, a brand new print-only newspaper that'll focus on state government and politics. As we welcome a new publication, we say goodbye to a longtime columnist, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette columnist Jack Kelly, who wrote his final column this week for that newspaper. But first, housing in the Pittsburgh region, availability and accessibility, they vary based on your point of view, or more likely based on your economic situation. New housing developments seem to be going up all over the area, with many signs saying starting at 200K or 300K. But there's also a demand for affordable housing for low and low to middle income individuals and families. Joining us in studio to get a better picture of the overall housing picture, the challenges, Kate Giamarese, reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome, Kate. Good to have you here.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And Linda Metropolis is the director of Action Housing and Neighborhood Development at Action Housing. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you.
If you have a question or comment, you can tweet us at WESA Confluence. All right. I spoke with Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto and Allegheny County Executive Rich Fitzgerald separately last month about their goals for 2017, their top priorities. Each mentioned increasing access to affordable housing. Here's Rich Fitzgerald.
We really want to work more on affordable housing with some of the developments that are going on. We see good growth occurring in this region, which I'm very pleased with, but not everybody is sharing in that growth.
So let's start with, to me, is an obvious question. Is there a specific definition for affordable housing, and does it vary from government level to government level? Let's start with Linda.
It can vary from program to program, but traditionally affordable housing is defined as housing that is affordable to people at 60% area median income or less. And so when you look at a program like the Low Income Housing Tax Credit Program, that's structured to serve people who in a single family household would be at about $29,000 a year or less. Now, the need, though, can vary. There are people at 30% of area median income, 50% of median income, that have larger needs even than the people who are at 60%. So there are different programs to focus on different levels of income.
Kate, do you find when you're reporting on housing issues, and this in particular, affordable housing, that there is confusion about that term at all, or do people understand that definition that Linda just mentioned?
I think there can be some confusion, and you know, and also as Linda alluded to, we don't have time to, you know, explain every single program here.
Right.
But you know, there's I think sometimes when you say affordable housing, people conflate that with, they think that you just mean traditional public housing,
right,
housing that's, you know, owned and operated and managed by the housing authority. And it's really much broader than that. That's one kind of affordable housing. But there's also, you know, as Linda mentioned, the low-income housing tax credit, which is a financing tool to help developers build affordable housing. There's also the Housing Choice Voucher Program, which is commonly referred to as Section 8, that allows people to have a voucher that allows them to find a rental unit in the private housing market. So there can be some confusion in it, and it does sort of refer to, I would say, like a broad array of programs.
So with the programs that you just mentioned, gave as an example, about how many units are we talking about, and do we have a true sense, a grasp on what is the demand, what is the need for, whether it's an individual program that Kate just mentioned, or overall by those categories?
Yeah, Kate. Well, so there was a task force convened last year by the city, which Linda was a member of, so I'll let her jump in if she wants to. But this task force concluded that our city of Pittsburgh is short about 17,000 approximately units of affordable housing, that there is that shortage. And I believe, and Linda can jump in if I'm wrong, that it noted that the shortage is most acute and most severe for people at the very lowest end of the spectrum, who are below approximately 30% of area median income. Mm-hmm. Am I recalling that correctly?
Yeah, before coming in today, I looked at some of those statistics, and the final report, I believe said 20,000 units. There's a shortfall in the city of Pittsburgh of 20,000 units that are needed for people at 50% area median income or less. So it would definitely take into account the very low income at 30%. The report also went on to say that there are about 45,000 households that spend more than 30% of their income on housing costs. And that's considered a cost burden. If you're spending too large a percentage of your income on housing, you have less money available for other things.
I would just also add that makes people more vulnerable to eviction and, possibly worst case scenario to homelessness if the rent eats up too large a portion of your paycheck.
Because if it may be an unexpected cost,
exactly,
not related to housing, hits you that you have to take care of.
That's exactly correct.
Now your housing is in danger.
Right.
Yeah.
Those numbers that you referred to and the task force, were we talking strictly city? Was it also Allegheny County? What?
The task force was specifically the city of Pittsburgh, but you would see the same issues throughout the county as well.
In terms of maybe percentage of numbers or not? Or
I don't have those statistics
okay.
me, but...
But what's your sense as you report on the issues?
Yeah, then? Just to be clear, that those numbers are referring just to the city of Pittsburgh, but, the broader trends that are responsible for that shortage, which, not to get too much into the weeds, but it's basically increasing costs of rent and the wages of renters stagnating or remaining the same. And those trends would also affect Allegheny County as well. While we don't have those numbers at our fingertips, it's not just a problem that's limited to the city limits of Pittsburgh.
So housing costs are going up, wages are not keeping pace to take care of that.
That's the basic problem.
That's right.
Okay. So we talked about the shortage. I do want to, but there's also, it's not just that, and this is maybe where a conflict comes in, and there's a development, or there are plenty of developments out in the North Hills and around. I'm from the North Hills, so I see these as I drive around. New housing developments, and the term luxury is used, and I mentioned before, the units starting at 200,000 or more, units starting at 300,000. You see these signs going up all the time. But there's also, in the city of Pittsburgh, luxury housing. Let's get a sense of, what does that mean? Does it have a different definition in terms of dollars? And is there really a demand for luxury housing within the city proper?
Well, a lot of the new housing, and I've heard anywhere of numbers from 8,000 to 11,000 units of housing, so apartments we're talking about right now, that have been developed and are in development right now, and that none of them are affordable to even median income households. So you have, and there's a reason for that, but you have a lot of growth in the city, a lot of new construction. I think there's varying degrees of how those units are filling up, and if we're going to reach a tipping point where the new projects are not going to fill up as quickly as they did 3 or 4 years ago. But the fact remains that most of that housing is available and affordable to people who are well in excess of median income. So we're not even talking about the low income and meeting the need for the low income households to have housing in the city of Pittsburgh. We're talking about a lot of new housing, none of which is affordable to low-income people. Typically, it's the low-income housing tax credit program that can help to bring private investment to help underwrite the cost of new affordable housing for people who are at 60% area median income or less. Typically, in the city of Pittsburgh, we get enough tax credits to provide about 200 new units of housing each year.
And the 200, go ahead.
I was just going to add that the task force we keep referring to, one of their recommendations that they issued was a greater utilization of those tax credits to create more affordable housing.
You mentioned luxury housing, Linda, in the city. Now, there are some new condos in the Bloomfield area that I believe are right around the $250,000 mark, about $800 or so per square foot. And yet, you know, a mile or two away, maybe in Staten Heights, you can get a house that's about 60 years old for maybe a quarter, maybe a half cost per square foot. So what is it? Is it strictly location? I mean, there is housing stock there, but is there not the demand for it for the people who can afford this amount, but the people who might not be able to afford it can't afford the 60-year-old home either?
I do believe that there is an interest both from homeowners and renters to live in stronger communities that offer a wide variety of amenities. And so the perception that living in East Liberty or Lawrenceville or Bloomfield or sort of those East End neighborhoods that have really seen a lot of revitalization over the last 3 to 4 years, it's just more attractive. Yes, you can move out to Morningside. Morningside's getting more expensive. Staten Heights is. And there are more affordable options, but they're not necessarily as desirable to a larger population as the cities that really have, or the neighborhoods that have really seen a lot of revitalization, like Lawrenceville. It's a classic point.
But is that bubble in Lawrenceville going to burst at some time?
I know, I would have thought it would have happened already, but it'll be interesting to see once it does happen. But rents and housing sales prices are just astronomical compared to where they were 5 years ago.
Well, it's not necessarily in itself a bad thing. That shows the attractiveness. But if you don't have on the other end of the spectrum good housing for lower income individuals, that makes
sense. Well, I would say in the case of Lawrenceville, to some extent East Liberty, other East End neighborhoods that a lot of people have actually been displaced. And so while there may not even be new options for affordable housing, the naturally occurring affordable housing is all but disappearing in those communities.
And I would also add, you know, I think people have expressed concerns that we don't want the character of our city to be changed too dramatically. No one's saying it's not good to have some types of luxury and you know, high-end housing. That's fine. But again, I think some of the people that I've spoken to, I attended one of the meetings last year, sort of the community meetings that the task force facilitated. And a lot of the residents I spoke to just felt like, you know, I know some people consider East Liberty, the changes in East Liberty, to be a success story. But one of the, you know, residents that I spoke to at one of the public meetings, she said, when I drive through East Liberty, it hurts my heart. She said, I don't want my neighborhood to be the next East Liberty. So people do have concerns just about the changing, dramatic changes in neighborhoods.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We are talking about affordable housing in the Pittsburgh area. In a recent interview with the mayor, he told me that he views affordable housing as a major challenge confronting the city.
I can tell you that equity is a big part of what our challenges will be. There's also disparity between the haves and the have-nots in the city in the new economy. And affordable housing and early education for our kids are different ways that we can address those, so they have to be part of the solution.
So is access to housing sort of a lift all boats kind of issue?
I think that a lot of the housing advocates that you speak to make the point that if you don't have stable housing in your life, everything else is at risk. Everything else, you know, can fall apart. That is a very much a fundamental part of making sure that everyone has, yes, you know, a stable life.
So they would agree with the mayor's assessment. It is sort of a social equity issue.
It is an important need.
Okay. I want to ask you about something City Council did late last year, and that was they approved creation of a housing opportunity fund, but no revenues were designated at that time to fund the fund. So I want to get an idea of what the intention of the fund is, and I know, Kate, that you covered this issue throughout 2016, whether it should be on the ballot, which it did not, to the approval by City Council. So what's the intent of the Housing Opportunity Fund?
Well, so the fund was one of the key recommendations of the task force. And again, as you pointed out, there's no funds for the fund yet. But the plan was to, the eventual goal is to have it be funded at approximately $10 million a year. And that could go towards a wide variety of uses that would, you know, help to create new affordable housing or, you know, potentially preserve certain housing that we already have. You know, I think there's a very broad vision for it that it could be something like, say, if you're a low-income homeowner who needs to make a repair to your property, it would, you know, hopefully be able to be used for something like that. And as to the sources of that $10 million are still being debated.
And it is focused on the lower-income households.
Right.
So there is a intent not to make most of that money available at the 60% area median level, but really to structure it more for the very low income households, 30 to 50%.
Mm-hmm. We have about 2 minutes left. I want to bring up this, and maybe I'm way off, but in certain neighborhoods, there are fairly high percentages of vacant and abandoned houses, and not all of them need to be torn down or demolished. Is there a way that maybe whether it's this fund or another program could tap into that housing stock that is there that needs repair, that do need to be repaired, but to help low-income people to inhabit a structure that can be made or made more livable?
You know, I'm not sure if that would be one of the uses of the fund. And I know, I think Pittsburgh technically has a land bank. I don't know that it's done much yet,
right.
But that is, I think, sort of one of the visions, too, that a land bank could fill that role.
There are also other loan programs already in existence that the Urban Redevelopment Authority operates specifically for people to be able to borrow money at very low cost to do renovations. Unfortunately, a lot of these houses that have been abandoned could take $100,000, $150,000 to fix them up and may have environmental issues. So we all would like to see those buildings repurposed, but it's going to take a fair amount of money to do so.
Okay, 1 minute left. What's the biggest challenge that we have to help meet this challenge of affordable housing in the years ahead, what you've reported on, Kate, and what you've seen as we'll start with you, Linda.
Well, rather than saying what the challenge is, okay, I'd say that there are a lot of opportunities.
Okay.
And so I was really heartened by being part of the Affordable Housing Task Force, because there were a lot of opportunities that were discussed and put on the table. Now there has to be some political will to help put those things into place. But this is not, you know, one solution is going to solve everything. So we really do have to take advantage of the 6 to 10 different opportunities that might be out there to bring the money to the table.
Okay.
Well, I don't want to rain on Linda's optimism, but just to address more of the challenges side, I think that there's sort of an uncertain federal landscape and what going forward, what support there will be for certain affordable housing programs at the federal level, and sort of declining support also for traditional public housing over time. And just like uncertainty, like I said, things like the affordable housing tax credit or low-income housing tax credit, just uncertainty.
Mm-hmm. Kate Giamarese is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Linda Metropoulos is Director of Housing and Neighborhood Development at Action Housing. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
A bit of a rarity, a new print-only newspaper launched this week and will focus on state government operations and politics in Pennsylvania. That's coming up on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. In the opening of the 2017-18 legislative session this week in Harrisburg, Speaker of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, Mike Terzai, said, quote, "The majority party does have an obligation to govern, and the minority party has an obligation to participate and be part of moving legislation forward," end quote. And the news media has an obligation to report on the activities of our government and elected officials. A new print-only newspaper, The Caucus, launched this week and will focus on state government and politics. Joining us now by phone from Harrisburg, veteran Capitol reporter Brad Bumstead, who is the bureau chief for The Caucus. Brad, welcome.
Thank you very much, Kevin. I appreciate you having us on.
And in studio, we're joined by Mike Wershagen, investigative reporter for The Caucus. Welcome back, Mike.
Thanks, Kevin.
Okay, if you have a question or comment, you can tweet us at WESA Confluence. I want to get to your front page story of the first issue about pensions, state workers, crimes. But first, sort of an industry question. A print-only weekly publication, how can this succeed? Not in terms of the quality of the reporting. We know the work of you guys. But as a business model, Brad, I'm going to start with you on that one.
Well, I can't really tell you how it'll succeed as a business model. That's not my job. Our job is to make sure it succeeds by the quality of stories that we do. They have a business model. They have a plan to market this by subscription, and that's great. And I feel really confident that the organization behind this, LNP Media Group, given what they've done so far, is really doing a lot to market it. There are billboards up here in Harrisburg. We cut a TV ad that's going to air pretty soon, and we're going to have a new office right here on State Street momentarily. So they've done a lot to increase the presence, you know, for the caucus. But beyond that, I guess it gets into marketing and sales is not really our strong point.
And journalists don't want to be involved in it. You want to do the work that you love, reporting, right?
Right, exactly.
Mike?
Yeah, it also, I think, helps that we have a pretty narrowly tailored focus. We're looking only at state government, and our target audience, the people we're writing for, are people who are involved in state government or in covering state government in some way or, you know, some way, shape, or form.
Okay. Now, Brad mentioned LNP Media Group. They publish a daily newspaper in Lancaster County as well. So I just wanted to update people. Okay, let's get to the journalism aspect of it, the focus that you both alluded to. In your first edition, the publisher and editor explained, you're not trying to duplicate the work of journalists who cover the Capitol or compete with organizations in the 24-hour news cycle. So what do you see? What has been the charge to you, Brad, as the bureau chief, and you, investigative reporter Mike, what is the charge given to you as far as your role, your niche, for this newspaper?
Oh well, my charge is to do whatever Brad tells
me. Is investigative reporting on state government, and that's another factor that goes beyond the current trend with social media and newspapers dying around the country. We're starting up a print publication, and the focus is on investigative reporting. When you see newspapers at other of all sizes, you know, pulling back from any kind of investigative reporting to speak of, save for the really large papers, because it's costly.
And you were saying, Mike? I'm sorry.
Oh, right. We have that mandate to focus on that, you know, the investigative journalism on deeper dives, and we also have the time to do that, which is immensely helpful. It's one of those things that the 24-hour news cycle, which we've been talking about for a decade now, and has only really sped up in recent years, can hinder reporters in that it gives you less time to dig into something, to really get deep into the records and to see where the data points you, and get a better sense for where things are going and where things might be going wrong. One of the things that we have is time to actually pour through that, pour over that, and I think we've already been doing some pretty interesting work because of that.
And because of that, that gives you, I don't want to say a luxury, but instead of those daily deadlines, you have time to do even a even a better story because these things do take the time to find the information you need to deliver.
As somebody who loves doing this job, I think it's absolutely a luxury.
Brian, I mentioned briefly at the beginning your long tenure as Capitol Bureau Chief for the Tribune Review. So what new challenges, opportunities will the caucus provide for you individually that maybe you couldn't do or couldn't do as extensively prior to this? So if you would.
Well, sure. I mean, that's Mike touched on. They are enormous opportunities to not be locked into the 24-hour news cycle. And it goes back to, I started here in Harrisburg for Gannett Company and worked for four different newspapers at a time. And they all wanted to, you know, feed, daily feed, and it involved numerous stories, but few of them of real quality most of the time. Occasionally you could dig into something. At the Trib, as the Harrisburg reporter, faced much the same. I mean, we could still really occasionally dig in, but there were still the daily demands that you had to jump back to that. And here, the luxury that you asked about is basically a week to do a story. Now, sometimes that would seem harder than you realize, but we're trying to work ahead so that we have a couple things, you know, backed up here, ready to go.
Right.
And I have to say, it doesn't seem like a luxury by the time you're coming up on the deadline. So, because the stories are much more complicated and there's, you know, it takes a lot more time to put together.
Brad Brumstead is the bureau chief of the brand new newspaper, The Caucus, and Mike Wershagen is an investigative reporter for The Caucus. We're talking about that. We're talking about their coverage specifically of state government and politics. And you can tweet us a question if you would like at WESA Confluence. So let's move on to the top investigative story in your first issue this week, having to do with state pensions. Now, I want to tell you, I spoke with Governor Wolf this week about if he thinks that after many years, there will be reform to the pension system for state workers and school teachers.
I think we can reach agreement on that. There was a bill that passed the House that I supported, and it didn't pass the Senate. There are ways that we can reach bipartisan agreement on this. I agree that we can't kick this can down the road any longer.
Okay. Now, Governor Wolf was talking about pension reform in terms of retirement benefits for state workers and teachers, whether new employees should have a defined contribution plan, sort of a 401k or a defined benefit, while also reducing the state's pension debt. But your story, the focus was of this investigative piece on pensions had to do with convicted felons, former state workers, teachers, still collecting pensions. Brian, let me start with you. How did this story come about? Was it something that's been on your radar for a while? Did somebody bring it to your attention? How did it come about, Brad?
No, it's something I have been thinking about for a while, but just didn't have the time to really delve into it to the extent that I needed. What it's about is that, and we've all dealt with this issue of pension forfeiture over the past 10 years as numerous state officials were convicted of corruption and numerous crimes. And, you know, you certainly had some of them from Allegheny County in Western Pennsylvania, Representative Mike Vion and John Ori Melvin, a Supreme Court justice.
Senator Ori.
There was a law passed by the legislature in 1978 that basically says if you commit one of a certain number of crimes, you lose your pension automatically. And there's no debate about that if it fits the crime. And those crimes tend to fit the abuse of office that you would see, whether that's perjury, obstruction of justice, official oppression, things like that. But it's long occurred to me that there were other crimes that might be more severe in a way than that do not result in pension forfeiture. And indeed, we started looking for those and found out that one former state trooper convicted of murder serving a life sentence still gets a pension. That a teacher who was convicted of sexual assault of a child, a former teacher, still gets a pension. And the sex crimes were added in 2004 by amendment, and but they again apply to specific crimes, and they have to do with nexus to the job. Now, sexual assault of a child is one of those crimes, but in this case, one case we found, we were told by the state pension board officials that it didn't have any nexus with employment. Well, how could that be if you were a teacher and you had some kind of sexual act with a child? Well, it could be that it was your own child, or it could be that it was a neighbor's child, that it didn't happen during or after school. The kid wasn't even a student. I understand that, but I think a lot of people would say it's just as bad, if not worse, to have assaulted your own child. But those are the kind of things that will be debated in a bill by Representative Scott Petry, a Republican from Bucks County, who had put this up for a vote before, and it actually passed the House last session but died in the Senate.
Okay, so that's to close some of the loopholes. I mean, when you learned about this, it was like, I mean, when I first read the first couple of paragraphs of this story, it's like, what? You're giving examples, and Brad just alluded to a couple of the examples. I said, what? And they're still collecting. I believe that teacher that you alluded to, Brad, is collecting $45,000 a year in pension. And it's like, I said, oh, my goodness. So, Mike, when you first heard about this, it was like, what was your reaction?
Well, it's pretty amazing to see. I mean, you see, you know, theft, bribery, perjury, obstruction, official oppression on this list. But then you see there's a music teacher who shot his wife, and he's still getting paid, you know, state money.
Because it had nothing to do with his job?
Because that was not a part of his job. Another thing that really jumped out at me from what Brad found in this is that, you know, as he mentioned, we've talk about pensions and pension forfeiture in these large high-profile cases when it's a state Supreme Court justice, when it's a state senator or a House member. But we don't talk about it in these other smaller cases, not smaller cases, I'm sorry, in these other cases with people who are less well-known, because there's no requirement to report this. And that was something Brad found that I think was very, very interesting. No one has to send court records to the state employee retirement system or to the public education retirement system. Nobody has to inform these boards that somebody who is on their roll has just stabbed a dentist to death.
So, Brad, will Representative Petry's legislation, will that address the reporting requirements or not?
Oh, he says it will, absolutely. And he has a couple versions of his bill, you know, to throw them out there and see which one can get the most votes, I guess. And one of those is to require forfeiture for any felony, not just the enumerated crimes, but any felony that would be committed. But he still has it, I believe, subject to employment. But it would broaden the scope of who could lose their pension. He has another one that would apply much more narrowly just to the crime of conflict of interest. And that is something that you see come up in corruption cases where it happened on numerous occasions where state officials who were convicted in a broader sense were plea bargained with by prosecutors for a broader range of crimes would plead guilty to conflict of interest, which is not an enumerated crime. Therefore, they could keep their pension, and that was part of the impetus for reaching that deal on the part of a defendant.
Gentlemen, we have 2 minutes left, and also there's so much in that first issue of the caucus. But in that first issue, you did an analysis of 10 issues likely to be considered in this new 2-year legislative session, everything from property tax reform to pension reform to gaming law fix. Each of you, pick one that you think would be most likely to be addressed the quickest by the legislature. We'll start with Mike. Or do you want me to start with Brad?
Oh, boy. You know, I'm not sure. There are so many things that you've seen come up in front of the legislature that even things that you would think would be no-brainers, like when Republicans had complete control of both branches, of the executive and the legislative branch, and liquor control, LCB reform came up, state store reform came up, and it still didn't get anywhere. I mean, I'm not sure I can pick something that I think they're really going to jump all over, although Brad's probably got a much better sense of that than I do.
Well, Brad, you had to deal with them on a day-to-day basis for years, so what do you think?
Well, I mean, it's no different than any year, and that is the the first 6 months of this year are going to be almost solely focused on the state budget. That's particularly true whenever there's a deficit, as Governor Wolf says there is this year, so does the Independent Fiscal Office, at least $600 million, and maybe on a structural deficit basis into the next year, $1.3 or up as high as $1.7 billion. So that's going to really occupy most of their interest. But on these other issues, I think one that is going to come up pretty quickly is the issue of property tax shifting or property tax elimination. And there really is a huge push for the latter, the elimination in the Senate. There are a number of taxpayer groups that are just rabid about this. They believe that increasing state taxes, will provide enough revenue to eliminate property taxes. Skeptics and critics of this say it won't even be close. You can't raise enough. I mean, you would have to raise the state taxes so high, like the income tax, that it'll never pass in reality. I do not know the answer to that at this point as to which is correct, but I know what Governor Wolf favors, and that is tax shifting, where just a certain portion of local property taxes would be replaced by state taxes. A significant portion, he would say, but there would still be some local commitment to education, which he thinks is necessary.
All righty, Brad. We'll look forward to your coverage of that. Brad Bumstead is the bureau chief. Mike Wershagen is an investigative reporter for the new weekly newspaper focusing on Pennsylvania government and politics, The Caucus. We wish you the best of success, and thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A veteran Pittsburgh newspaper columnist says farewell. A visit with Jack Kelly is next when The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. There are reporters, there are editors, and then there are columnists who not only put their writing out there for public scrutiny, but also their perceptions, their thoughts. Jack Kelly has been a columnist for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette since 1998. His farewell column was published in Sunday's paper. Jack Kelly joins us in studio. Welcome, Jack. Good to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me, Kevin.
If you have a question or comment for Jack, you can tweet us at WESA Confluence. Jack, I'm going to give you a very basic, very dry definition of a columnist. Quote, a journalist who offers opinions and commentary. Now, how would you define the role of a columnist, either in general or maybe your role with the Post-Gazette or even before that?
Well, first, I would say that your definition is fine, but I would add the words, who openly does it. There are too many so-called journalists who substitute their opinions for facts in news columns.
And admit, but who openly and put it out there that this is my thought.
Opinion columnist is making it clear that what he or she is saying is laced with or is altogether opinion. And that's certainly better than expressing opinion in the news columns sub rosa, which goes on too much and has a lot to do with journalism's problems today.
At the very end of this final column that you wrote and was published in the Sunday PG, you thanked your readers, quote, even those of you who only read my column to work up a lather of indignation, end quote. Is that part of your job? Whether it's maybe not indignation, work up a lather of indignation, but to get a reaction, to get somebody to think, to get somebody to maybe even emote?
Well, from a commercial standpoint, anything we do to encourage readership.
Okay.
We're being published largely to encourage readership, and controversy tends to do that. That's one thing. It is, of course, given that most journalists have considerable egos, columnists more so than most journalists, so it's always nice if you can sway someone's opinion. But it doesn't happen a whole lot. Not too many minds are changed by opinion columns.
Or maybe you help reinforce their opinion that might be different than yours.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Now, you came to Pittsburgh from Toledo?
I came from Toledo.
Okay. And you came as a columnist?
No, I've been a reporter almost all of my time.
And when did you become?
As well as a columnist.
Right. As well as.
Yes.
During the same time.
Yes.
How do you feel about reporter, columnist? And do you see any reader's reaction? Well, hold it. He's a reporter here. He's a columnist there. Do they separate it? How do you separate the two when you're doing both?
Well, I've never found any difficulty being able to separate the roles because they're different. You know, the job of a reporter doing straight news is to be fair, to be accurate, and to be detailed. And I find that easier to do when I was reporting on news, I think in part because I did have a column, because I had an outlet for my opinions, for saying what I thought about what I was reporting on. So I didn't feel any need to spin what I was reporting on.
So you weren't, in a sense, concerned that maybe some of the columnist Jack Kelly would make its way into the reporter Jack Kelly?
I was never concerned about that with me, because
okay.
That was not a problem. I can understand why there would be a perception of the difference, and there has been a debate among journalists about whether opinion journalism and straight reporting, whether there should be a Chinese wall or something more substantial, or maybe none at all. And I understand why that's discussed, but I certainly think that someone like me, who did both, is better than to have a frustrated opinion writer sneaking his or her opinions where they don't belong in news columns.
Okay, I'm not going to ask you out of all the columns which your favorite is. I'm certainly not going to do that. If you wish to volunteer it, that's fine. But I'm going to ask you, is there one or two that were the most difficult to write?
Of columns, not really.
Mm-hmm.
And what I remember most about journalism and so forth are the news stories
I was
able to write. Back when newspapers were flush, John Robinson Block, the publisher of the Post-Gazette and of the Blade,
right.
before that, and gave me some marvelous opportunities to report on some major events. And I'm most proud with some of the stories and some of the things I did back in the day, if you will.
Give us an example, please. A particular story that you reported on.
My favorite for a lead, for creating a lead.
Okay.
Was the one that began, "I'm standing at the end of the road to nowhere. I am not speaking figuratively of my career in journalism. I'm 500 miles north of the nearest tree." And I was covering the creation of the first native governed territory in North America, the Nunavut, the eastern half, if you will, of the what had been the Northwest Territories. It is run by the Inuit.
Right.
And the capital city is Iqaluit, formerly Forbesher Bay. It's about population about 5,000 at the time I was there. Fascinating little community. There's about 20 miles of paved road in all of Nunavut, which is the size of Eastern Europe, probably the size of Europe. And half of them are in Iqaluit. A mile and a half of the paved road it's called literally the road to nowhere. It starts in the mm-hmm. center of the town and went out to where a garbage dump had been but no longer was. And so when I heard about the road to nowhere, I had to go out to the end of it, which I did during a blizzard. there were several of them, and so I could see maybe 2 feet in front of my face, but it gave me my most satisfying lead. And it was one of the more interesting experiences I had overall, being in Iqaluit for the creation of the new territory and learning about the community and its bigger issues.
And you were doing that story for what publication?
I did that. Well, it was published in both the Blade and the Post Gazette.
Okay.
But I was on the Blade's payroll at the time, and this is back.
And the Blade is in Toledo, of course.
Yes, when newspapers were flush, proper profit margins were above, average around 21%, and. John liked spending the money. He had a particular fondness with parliamentary systems and sent me to cover some marvelous things, the Quebec referendum, this creation, none of it, two Canadian national elections.
So we just have a few minutes left, too many questions. Has the role of the newspaper columnist changed, do you think, especially with the explosion of bloggers?
Well, I mean, there are more opinions out there than there were before, and many of them are more expert than those journalists. You know, we're sort of jacks of all trade, masters of none.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, the Powerline blog was run by three attorneys. So if you want comment on legal affairs, it beats the heck out of what most journalists have to offer, and you know, in other things. So blogs can be a sharper competition, if you will.
I want to ask you, you wrote many, many columns during the most recent presidential campaign. Is there a part of you that says, well, maybe I should keep doing this because with what we can expect as what we anticipate, a very different presidency, that there might be a lot of material out there for a columnist like yourself?
Well, there always will be a lot of material if you look for it. And there's greater uncertainty about what a Trump presidency portends than for any other president-elect.
Just because he's different?
Well, because we don't know what he is.
Oh, okay.
And he's so not what we've been used to, or is easy to box or to... a pillory. It's just we just don't know what's in store, and that will be interesting.
But so will there be a temptation on your part as you see this develop, as you see this presidency take effect, to say, "Oh, I'm going to start writing something"? Do you think?
Well, I'll look for occasional outlets for opinion, and hopefully where I can express it and have more than 660 words in which to express it. But for the meantime, for the near term, I'm not going to miss it much. Now, Pam and I, my wife, Pam, we have a retirement project is to write a book about the glorious, the historical novel about the glorious revolution of 1688. And so I'm moving the bulk of my attention from the 21st century to the end of the 17th.
Well, we'll look forward to your continued writing. Just real quickly, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, do you read other columnists? And do you, if so, do you read them from the point of view as a columnist or a reader?
Both. And I read a lot. And because both the people that I thought were competition, people that I admired, people that I thought had something special to offer. And I'm particularly fond of Krauthammer, Charles Krauthammer, and of Kurt Schlichter, who's new to the business, but is a retired Army colonel, a trial lawyer in Southern California, who has a gonzo approach to conservatism that I really like.
Jack Kelly retired this week after 18 years as a columnist for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Jack, thanks, and good health to you.
Thank you.
And what's coming ahead? In 2 weeks, there'll be a special edition of The Confluence at 9 o'clock before our coverage of the inauguration of Donald Trump. So for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Our engineer, Tom Hurley, the producer of The Confluence, is Marcus Charleston. I'm Kevin Gavin. Hope you have a good week of good news.